Today's episode is brought to you by Prince Street, Dean and DeLuca's monthly podcast dedicated to the delicious and infinite connections between people and food. Each new Prince Street podcast features special guests, field reports, and meals from around the world. Editor-in-Chief Howie Kahn hosts the show, featuring segments from correspondents such as Griffin Dunn, Jay McInerney, Eden Grinspan, and Sierra Tischgart. Download Prince Street on iTunes and online at livefromprincestreet.com. Prince Street, a fresh new podcast with a culinary heart.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey girls, hey, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Gilly Houston.
And I'm Donna Yen.
And we're the editorial assistants at Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. As some of our West Coast listeners already know, our regular hosts, Carrie and Claudia, aren't here today because they're soaking up some sun in California. They hosted a really fun launch party last night for the new issue of Cherry Bomb at the beloved Omnivore Books cookbook shop in San Francisco. We unfortunately couldn't be there because I was traveling for 20 hours yesterday home from the Caribbean, and Donna was holding down the fort at Cherry Bomb HQ, but we hear it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I was a little worried about you. We thought I'd be here by myself hosting the show, so I'm happy you made it in one piece.
I wasn't totally sure I was going to make it, but a few shots of espresso later, and we're here, and we're doing this thing.
Yeah, a lot of awesome women from the latest issue were there at last night's Omnivore party, like Tartine's Liz Pruitt, Brown Sugar Kitchen's Tanya Holland, Robin and Robin from Smitten Ice Cream, and Heidi Swanson from 101 Cookbooks. Plus, a lot of our podcast listeners were there, too. So if you're one of those people, thank you for coming by.
Alrighty, well, before we get started with this jam-packed show, we have to give a shout-out to the sponsors who help make the radio magic happen.
Prince Street, the new fresh podcast with a culinary heart from Dean and DeLuca. Baldor Specialty Foods, which curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. And the National Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, where you can start your journey to becoming a natural foods chef today.
On today's show, we're going on our very own mini Euro trip, and we're positive by the end of it, you'll be searching for your passport. Earlier this spring, Carrie talked with Anna Roche, the celebrated chef of Hiša Franco in Slovenia, about the latest chapter in her very interesting and unexpected career. Anna is one of the culinary badasses who will be showcased in season 2 of the documentary series Chef's Table, which begins May 27th on Netflix. Here's their conversation.
Hey everybody, our special guest today is Anna Roche, the chef owner of Hiša Franco, a restaurant in Slovenia. She is one of the stars of the new season of Chef's Table, the Netflix series about the world's most inspiring and creative chefs. Anna, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you for the invitation.
We're so excited that you're here. So let's go right into it. How did you become a chef?
Well, it's a love story, actually. A student of international science and diplomacy in Italy. And just before I graduated, I met my husband. And they had a restaurant, a small restaurant on Slovenian far west, on Italian border. A simple place run by his parents. And so when I graduated, instead of heading for Brussels for a diplomatic career, I actually decided to stay. And after a few years of working most in the service, managing the place, I decided to cook.
Wow, that's a big transition.
Huge.
So were you growing up? Were you into food? Did you already cook?
No, when I was growing up, I was practically professionally into skiing, heavy sports, and school, because I had very serious parents, which always said school is first and then sports comes. So there was no time for fun and no fun for time for cooking. So it all came late. I started cooking a little bit as a student, you know, the meals, after party meals, like midnight or 5 o'clock in the morning, pasta. And so when I met my husband, I was like, we say tabula rasa, I was like the empty piece of paper. So yeah, it all started there and from the beginning.
And everyone was fine with you wanting to make that transition from front of house to the kitchen with no chef skills?
Well, nobody was fine with that, especially my parents. I think my father didn't speak to me something like 6 months because I come from a family of doctors and diplomats, and it was a dream that someone continues that career. So he kept on saying me, but you are going to throw away all the years of studying and finish in a restaurant. So, I needed to fight the emotions or hurting someone around me. But then at the end, when you succeed, it's repaying.
So tell us about Hisha Franco. What kind of restaurant is it?
It's a beautiful countryside house on the Slovenian western part. So it's on Italian border, 3 kilometers from it. The countryside is just amazing. Slovenia was just declared by the Yale University as the fifth greenest country in the world. And imagine the valley where I come from is even greener than the rest of Slovenia. The rivers are turquoise, and from all the mountains you can actually spot the sea. So
wow.
This house is under the forest with cows and goats around. It looks like a little bit solitary, but it's mostly full, so I would say we are not alone because there is plenty of clients around. We have 10 rooms for guests since we are far away from bigger cities and places where people could lodge.
And how many guests can you seat at the restaurant?
35.
Oh, okay.
When we do lunch and when we do the service inside, when we do the garden, we come up to 50 because we can also sit people beside a beautiful alpine stream, which is born just behind the house.
That's the table I would like to book.
You
right
can.
Now.
It has a beautiful mountain view.
So tell us about the menu. What's the food like?
The food is mine. It is dedicated to the land where I come from, to the season. It has a lot of my personality, so it's full of contrasts. It's a happy food. But I think the particular thing of it is it came spontaneously. But whichever mountain you climb around us, it's enough you go 1,000 meters, you spot the sea. You actually can count in a beautiful weather the ships in the Gulf of Trieste. So I think something very special about my food is spicing up the land countryside dishes with the fish. So there are quite crazy combinations like squids with lamps with breads and local cheese, which is re-fermented in the cave, or the deer heart with oysters. So it's never boring in our place.
I love that you called it happy food. I don't think I've ever heard a chef describe his or her cuisine as happy food.
You know, you go sometimes to the restaurant and you eat very well, but you go outside and there's no really big emotions around that. And you say, well, we had a good evening, but the day after, you hardly remember anything. When you have or you speak about happy food, then I think we all are enthusiastic about things. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't know if you liked something, you still talk about that the day after. I think this is really making people happy. So
that's Gilly pouring the water, in case you're wondering what that noise is in the background. It's recording live here at Radio Cherry Bomb. You know, I read, I want to talk about how you source your food. Do you have relationships with farmers, foragers, fishermen, all of that?
Hisha Franco being so far away from big suppliers, because the countryside has no highways. We actually have a mountain road coming to us from all possible directions. So the suppliers would normally say, if you want something, we send you by bus. So imagine oysters coming by bus. No. It's something really crazy. So in the last 10 years, we hardly worked on making a network of local producers, but not because it is something fashionable, but because we needed it. We needed it
to
survive and to cook with a good ingredient. So this network has now plenty of different personalities foraging for us, gardening for us, some farm, others produce great cheeses, cottage cheeses and butter. So you can see in the mushroom period, like four people coming to the house. One is having black trumpets, another one porcini mushrooms. But just what they picked in that moment. So sometimes it's just four porcini mushrooms, and you have to handle with that. Sometimes he has, I don't know, three, four baskets with it. So I think this means that a chef must really listen to the nature and be very elastic. So it means if it's raining for 2 days, it's very probable that porcini are not coming out. So you need to figure out something new, something else. So it's beautiful because it's always challenging. And so then we are helping people survive, because by doing this chain of producers, we actually have a product which never traveled, so it's really kilometer zero. But the producer is stimulated to continue foraging, farming,
doing all of that. It sounds magical. So let's jump ahead to and talk about the chef's table, since we only have a few more minutes with you. So how did the whole chef's table documentary come about?
Well, I actually got an email saying Netflix would like to have you at the next season of The Chef's Table. And I didn't bother a lot, because I'm more into reading than into television. So I think I didn't answer right away. And then I had a friend, Massimo Bottura, calling on a phone call we started a conversation with some of his head chefs, and I told them, and they said, no, do it, that's important, it's a great thing. So, and then some telephone conversations followed, and and that's it. So that was in July, and in September we started filming already.
Wow, how long did the cameras follow you around?
Almost 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Yeah, it was, I can't remember, the whole trip was there, the whole troop was there, something like 15, 16 days, but there was a director coming before, because she needed to spot places where to film and to construct the story, because, I mean, Slovenia is quite a known place, so you need to be there to see and understand.
So you have your own TV show in Slovenia, so you know what it's like to have to be on camera, have cameras follow you around. But for 3 weeks straight, that's a lot.
Well, we did years ago a few documentaries with Arte, the French-German TV program. And so that was where we learned the lesson. We did something with Servus TV in Austria when I was performing in Hunger 7 in Salzburg, and Red Bull is very strong in marketing, so they invested a lot of money in that. But I don't really have a TV program. I was a part of a morning program of the Slovenian National Television when it was more educational, because I tried to make people understand how to follow the season and how to understand what is regional, what is seasonal, how to use, let's say, products that they have but they forget to use. So, like, speaking about rhubarb, Slovenia is a great territory for rhubarb, but people sometimes just forget to cut it. They would prefer going and shop in the supermarket something that never almost saw a tree or a land. So I think this working on people that back to the nature is so important in a land that is so green as Slovenia is extremely important.
So what will we learn about you in the documentary?
I think you will understand a lot of my decisions, life decisions. You will meet my family. I
Your
have
mom.
Two children. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two children who actually grew up in the kitchen. Because the year I started cooking, I was pregnant with a boy, and then 16 months later, the daughter came. So we have moments of having both parked in the kitchen, playing in the kitchen. So and they still come very often because we live in Hisha Franco, so it's not just the restaurant, it's our house, it's our home.
Yeah, we talk a lot on the radio show about how to balance family and work, and for a lot of women, it's almost impossible.
Well, I proved it's possible. Mm-hmm. Even if I work a lot of hours, I still have my family around. So maybe a woman should be a chef owner. That's almost compulsory because then you can really dedicate your time in the kitchen, but you still can dedicate your time to your children.
And you're the boss.
And you're the boss. So if you say, I want to have dinner with my children, you do it and you feel okay after that. I think we should listen to ourselves because if a chef is not happy, then sooner or later, I think you start feeling his unhappiness in his creations. Mm-hmm. So I think a woman is fulfilled when she has a family. I'm very traditional about that. So I think if I needed to decide between never seeing my children and or not cooking, I would rather say not cooking. But since I can have both, I'm really happy. I'm the happiest person on planet for that.
I like the happy theme that's running through the conversation. I saw on the website that there's an Ernest Hemingway connection to Hisha Franco.
Yeah, it actually is, because Hisha Franco in the First World War was transformed to the hospital. The Isonzo Front was one of the strongest battles in the First World War. It was where actually Austrians pushed Italians to the Piave River. And Ernest Hemingway was there reporting about the battles. And he was hurt on his own to front. And the legend says that he was treated in Hisha Franco as a wounded reporter. And so if you read Farewell to the Arms, there is a story about Kubarit, so the place where I come from. It speaks about a tiny town with a white church and beautiful girls.
Okay, I haven't read that book since high school. It might be time to reread it. Okay, so Anna, we do this thing called the speed round, where we ask you a few questions very quickly. We have literally about 2 minutes left. So I'm going to throw some questions at you. You just give me some quick answers. Tea or coffee?
Tea.
How do you take it?
Warm.
Good answer. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
What's in your refrigerator at home?
Everything for pasta.
Oh, okay. Another reason to visit you. Favorite thing to eat?
Pasta.
Least favorite thing to eat?
Bad pasta.
Favorite snack?
I'm not snacking.
Oh, you're not a snacker?
No.
Okay. It's kind of an American thing, I guess, sometimes. Favorite kitchen tool?
Knife.
Okay. I like these straightforward answers. Place you'd like to travel to next?
I traveled a lot around the world, but maybe Mexico.
Okay, well, Anna, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for being on Radio Cherry Bomb. I've known about you for years now. It's an honor to finally meet you in person. I hope all of our listeners are inspired to put a trip to Slovenia on their bucket list and make sure you watch Anna's episode on The Chef's Table on Netflix. Thank you very much, Anna.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned for our next guest, the authors of the new deliciously carb-filled cookbook, Tasting Realm.
Were you into avocado toast before any of your friends? Do you know how to whip up some cashew cream? And do you make your own almond milk? If so, you're our kind of person, and you might be interested in the classes at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, located in the heart of Manhattan. Founded in 1977, NGI is the first culinary school dedicated to healthy cooking to be accredited nationally. Their professional chef's training program is offered full and part-time, and several of our favorite chefs are alumni, including Dirt Candy's Amanda Cohen, Alyssa Wagner of Dimes, and Chloe Coscarelli of By Chloe. Visit the NGI website to learn how you can transform your life and your career.
Welcome back, everybody. Our next guests are Katie Parla and Christina Gill, authors of the mouth-watering new cookbook entitled Tasting Rome, Fresh Flavors and Forgotten Recipes from an Ancient City. Carrie and Claudia spoke to them about their expat adventures and their favorite Roman foods. Let's hear about their delicious life and how Tasting Rome came to be.
Hey, everybody. So we are here with Christina Gill and Katie Parla. They are the photographer and author, respectively, of Tasting Rome, Fresh Flavors and Forgotten Recipes from an Ancient City. This is an incredibly beautiful book. I don't know anyone who doesn't like Italian food, so this book's kind of a no-brainer. If you're in a cookbook store or a bookshop, you just have to pick it up. And we are really thrilled that they are here in Bushwick, all the way from Rome. Yeah. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
It's good
Thank
to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So aside from the obvious, your cookbook came out last week. What brings you to town?
Oh, pizza, obviously. Always.
It's just good to come back and stop in, reconnect with the country.
The whole Celebrate country. Rome. New York loves Rome, so it's always fun to come through and feed people Grecia and talk about pizza.
How do you rate the pizza in New York compared to Rome?
There's some really delicious pizzerias and some less delicious.
Roberta's is pretty good.
Roberta's is pretty good. My favorite pizzeria actually is Razza in Jersey City.
So, oh,
yeah, it's
heard of that one.
Super delicious. It's the best. I can't stop talking about it. And
spell
I'm partial
it,
all
spell
things
it for
Jersey.
Us?
Razza. It sounds like pizza, but it's Razza.
Do you guys super nerd out on like the different styles of pizza? Like Roberta's is Napoleon?
Oh,
Neapolitan.
Gosh, don't look at
it's
me.
Like,
it's got the thick rim, and it sort of is reminiscent of Neapolitan-style pizza. I mean, there's so many different types that we encounter in Rome that are not Neapolitan-style, which I think are really fun to eat and perhaps haven't taken off in the U.S., like the sheet pan pizza, pizza al taglio.
And I'm from Nashville, so whenever I'm in Nashville, I eat at City House.
Oh, love City House.
Yeah. You've been to Nashville?
I love a lot of friends down in Nashville.
So I go to City House. It's just down the street from my father's house. So I like the pizza there, which is a thinner crust pizza.
So tell us how each of you wound up in Rome.
I mean, I studied Latin when I was in high school and decided when I was 16 that I was going to, like, be a Latin scholar. I did not end up doing that. But I did at that point decide that I wanted to live in Rome and I wanted to know everything about Rome's history. So I moved there when I was 22 and started doing art history things and then started doing food studies and beverage studies and things like that. And that was 13 years ago.
So I actually came over for work. I was in the U.S. Foreign Service in the diplomatic corps. So I went and did one tour at one-year tour at the embassy to the Holy See, to the Vatican, and 2 years at the embassy to Rome. But I just had a flash when Katie said 16. We did Model UN in
yes.
high school, and we were Italy, and we won for the best proposal. I think it was like a chemical weapons ban or something
That's awesome.
In high school, and I think that started it, and someone reminded me back then that I said, I'm going to go to Italy and move to Italy, so...
Not to bring up competing cookbooks, but I got an email from the Holy See recently, or the Holy See's public relations person. The Pope just put out a cookbook.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a little
probably
bit,
wasn't the Pope.
He probably had a ghostwriter. Just a theory. I don't know, but he...
Did you look at it?
I didn't. I just... I've got a few emails on my desktop to deal with before I delve into the Pope's cookbook, but I will.
Isn't he a chemist, though? He's like a scientist, right? That kind of makes sense that he would write a cookbook.
I'm not sure. Yeah, in all his spare time.
Huh. Okay. I'm kind of curious about that. I bet they eat well at the Vatican.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah.
Shouldn't they not eat well? Like, just have bread and water so they focus on...
But isn't that the thing about Italian food? You can eat simply and still eat well.
It's true. That bread and that water are going to be really delicious.
How did the two of you guys meet and start collaborating?
Okay, so the truth is that we met over Twitter because I was super obsessed with getting a Haston's bed, and somehow or another, I tried to convince Katie to join me to buy a Haston's bed, not one Haston's bed, but if we could try to get a 2-for-1 deal. And she's like, okay, that's a lot of Reader's Digest articles I've got to sell. Let me get a head start. And we just hit it off because we, you know, similar sense of humor, and we became social friends, not just social media friends.
And then we worked on a couple of articles together, one for Bon Appetit and one for Australia Gourmet Traveler. And yeah, we eat a lot of the same foods. We are pretty opinionated about what's delicious, and there aren't actually all that many places in Rome that are sort of hitting the mark these days.
There are not. Oh, tell us about that.
I mean, I think when I moved to Rome and when a lot of people visit Rome, you perceive the culture as one that is really deeply steeped in, like, quality and authenticity. But Rome is a city like any other and has its food system issues. And, like, there are a lot of tourists driving the food industry, especially in the center. So not all restaurant owners really respect their clientele, nor are they necessarily great at training kitchens. So there are all of these issues that really make it difficult to eat a great meal every single time. A lot of people actually end up cooking at home, which certainly helps. But you know, there are these, like, amazing places that we talk about in the book, like Mortier Vai, which is this great sort of Roman fast food stall in the Testaccio Market, or Cesare al Casaletto, which is this incredible trattoria. I mean, but if I list it off, you know, when people come to visit, they're like, give me your 5-day tour. I'm like, well, I've got, like, about 5 restaurants. You're going to have to fill it in with pizza by the slice and gelato during the day.
Sounds so hard.
Yeah, it's tough. Hard work.
Torture.
I just tell people just to punctuate each meal by walking. Just walk everywhere, and you can lose. I tell them this. I don't know whether it's actually true. They can lose weight, you know, have a gelato. You can have 10 in a day, but just make sure you walk to each place.
So you still have a day job, more or
yes,
less.
Yeah.
Tell us what you do with Design Sponge.
Okay, so Design Sponge is just a freelance column that I work on. It's a weekly column, and my day job is actually I'm a food assistance advisor. So I work for the Australians, managing a food aid portfolio for the bottom 10%. So the 10%. The most poor people in the world who don't have food. I manage the portfolio, making sure that the Australian contributions get food to these people through the World Food Program.
Oh, wow. I had no idea you do that.
That's my day
job. That could
job.
Be a whole other yeah. show, yeah. I feel like. Wow. Okay. So the cookbook. How did you two decide to collaborate on a cookbook?
Well, I think the fact that we do have such sort of similar experiences in Rome, as, you know, highly educated American expat women based in the society that we've chosen to make our home in, and we're both obsessed with food, and, you know, Christina is this, like, incredible visual talent, and I'm the sort of cultural historian aspect, and so sort of bringing those two visions of Rome together through a series of recipes, features, headnotes, and images, it sort of felt like a very natural process and one that was sort of overdue. There are plenty of, like, spectacular, outstanding traditional cookbooks, but people don't actually eat like that anymore. So we wanted to give readers, whether they're planning a trip to Italy or don't even have a passport, to get a sense of what people eat in Rome and also why they're eating that way and how they can reproduce that for their own tables.
And the other thing in coming up with this proposal is that since those other Rome cookbooks had come out to the market, cookbooks had really changed. They become much more visual. And I had the idea that we needed a modern cookbook that was driven by photography, that was real, that, you know, with the Airbnb economy and people going to cooking schools, people really want to know what locals do, how locals eat. And many expats do books, but I thought that it would be really great to do a book that wasn't an expat book. It wasn't tied to personalities, but it was actually tied to the food that was real food, not adapted for a palate or not watered down to be something else. And I wanted it to be something that could stand up to the criticism of an Italian reader, and that's really Katie's strength in setting the record straight, because Romans have a lot of myths about food that they pass on, which may not necessarily be true. So Katie has a lot of deep knowledge in that and distilling all of that information in the book.
So give us a few highlights from Tasting Rome. What are some things we can easily replicate back here in the States?
Everything?
Yeah, I mean, everything is really, really meant to be a dish that you can make at home. I think if you've got one sort of exception, that's the oxtail terrine, which requires a lot of oxtails, a lot of time, but that's, it's just such a special recipe from such a special place, a restaurant called Mazza, that we wanted to put that in. But the other 84 recipes are super accessible and you don't need any special equipment to do them. It does help, however, if you can sort of get really delicious, fresh, seasonal produce. And if you can't, you know, get Italian or Roman dandelion greens or, you know, arugula harvested in the Circus Maximus, you can sort of replace those things with what you have in your own backyard.
So how we worked on the book, I developed half the recipes in the book and Katie did the other half. And so she worked on adapting the recipes from restaurants and things that you would eat out for home preparation, and mine I developed really with the style of the design sponge in the kitchen with, which is quite simple to make, so they're all really easy. I would say if I could recommend one to start with, the oxtail stew, not the terrine, but the stew is absolutely wonderful. And for vegetarians, the souple, which are in the very first chapter, I think it's the first recipe in the book.
First three,
there are variations that are all obviously can be vegetarian as well, but you can use any leftover risotto and just make it into souple and fry it, put mozzarella in it, and it's really good.
Is that like a rice ball?
Yeah, it's a fried rice croquette.
Yum. Okay. What's the best time of year to visit Rome?
August.
Really?
No,
whenever.
I mean, it's really gorgeous right about now.
Yeah, spring.
Springtime is awesome as long as you can book your trip to avoid the Holy Week, which tends to be really, really crowded and terrible. And then sort of November, late October, early November are so, so lovely. But July's the hottest month. I always recommend people steer clear unless you want to be the only sweaty mess in a Roman restaurant, because Romans don't react to the heat the way that we do. I feel like in
October, I think
October's
is, the
good.
Peak, is the peak travel season. That, those are the highest prices, but like in Paris, when it's, you can't find a hotel room, Rome is really nice, nice then. Climate change has changed things a bit, but between,
totally.
If you go in May and you're traveling even around Italy, you still get the best of the colors and the scents of nature before the summer comes in and burns everything away. No, I mean that quite literally. Like if you were to go to Sardinia, if you go in May, you see all the flowers in bloom, and then as the summer goes, everything turns
and
brown.
Like the countryside bursts into flames. Yeah. Literally.
No, but that's true also.
It's true. There's, I was not joking.
Wow.
That's accurate.
Okay. And you see,
this is all valuable advice for the world travelers. And any little specifics, like are all the restaurants closed on Sundays and Mondays?
No, I mean, the place that I think we talk about the most in the book is randomly closed on Wednesdays. But, you know, Rome is a place that used to have really predictable, like, closing hours and closing months, and every place would shutter for Easter or whatever. But it's changed. Places are open and you can eat well Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Great.
Well, this made me want to go to Italy. I haven't been there in a while. But we're going to do a speed round with you guys.
Uh-oh.
Oh, don't worry. Everyone says uh-oh, but seriously, it's like coffee or tea?
Coffee.
How do you guys take it?
Black.
Black? And you?
Tea.
Tea?
Yeah, you're not a coffee drinker.
No.
That's weird.
What's in your refrigerator right now?
Hot sauce.
Different kinds of sriracha.
Do you guys have a favorite cuisine besides Italian?
Turkish.
I really am into Thai cuisine right now.
What's your favorite kitchen tool?
My Chemex, is that a tool?
Yeah.
My Chemex.
I really like my KitchenAid mixer.
What foods are you craving these days?
Dumplings.
Katie's stealing all my answers. So I'm gonna say hamburgers.
Is there anything you absolutely won't eat?
Raw wild rhubarb.
Awful.
Do you guys have any dream pet projects?
All of them.
Sure. I'd like to do an extensive travel project, so across more regions.
Where do you guys want to travel to next?
Georgia.
China.
Georgia the state or
country?
Just checking. Well, Katie Parla, Christina Gill, thank you so much for spending time with us. Their new book is called Tasting Rome. Be sure to check it out. It's a beautiful, beautiful book and one that all of you should have in your cookbook library. Thanks for coming by Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with author and trailblazer Mimi Sheraton.
Beginning as Balducci's Fruit Stand in Greenwich Village 70 years ago, Baldor Specialty Foods has been curating and delivering the highest quality foods in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Chefs rely on Baldor for the freshest and most seasonal ingredients, along with new and exciting items that you just can't get elsewhere. Baldor's ordering process is designed with a chef's schedule and priorities in mind to get you what you need when you need it. Baldor is the trusted resource and partner for the region's top chefs. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com.
Welcome back, everyone. In case you missed it, every week, iconic culinary writer Mimi Sheraton will be reading installments from her book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Here's what Mimi says you need to be eating this week.
Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton. I'm the author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Here's one to get you started. Pan Banya. Along the Côte d'Azur, the desire to make use of stale bread led to the creation of this sustaining and remarkably healthful summer sandwich that is essentially a salade niçoise heaped into a crusty loaf of French bread. Sliced in half lengthwise, the cut size of the dried baguette are liberally rubbed with garlic and doused with olive oil, hence the name pan banya, which means bathed bread. The fixings are layered in. Thinly sliced tomatoes, onions, green peppers, always hard-boiled eggs, and either the soft, salty accents of anchovy fillets or dark tuna that was cured in olive oil. The final touch is tiny black Niçoise olives, authentically unpitted, though the hazards of that are obvious. Once composed, the sandwich is wrapped firmly in wax paper, then covered with foil and pressed under weight for about an hour so that all the ingredients meld together and olive oil oozes out until it is a downright threat to pristine shirt fronts. A bib might well be in order.
Thank you, Mimi. Be sure to pick up Mimi's book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, at your favorite indie bookstore.
And thank you again to our sponsors for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts. Start your journey to become a natural food chef today by visiting ngihca.edu. Prince Street, a fresh podcast with a culinary heart. For more, visit livefromprincestreet.com or download the Prince Street podcast from iTunes. Baldor Specialty Foods curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com. And as always, thanks to our fearless engineer, DJ Dave. And for your chance to win a signed copy of Tasting Rome, go comment on our giveaway post on Instagram at @cherrybombmag.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and you're the bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.